Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Of course, we followed the House of Representatives dealing with foreign aid, bills that were passed over the weekend and carried across to the Senate side. The Senate will begin their deliberations on that later this afternoon and will likely take a final vote on the $95 billion allocated to our allies, to humanitarian efforts in Israel, in Ukraine, in Taiwan. And the question is, how did the Republican leadership in the House go about getting to the final passage of those bills so they could send them on to the Senate? So we want to get past the headlines of all of that. What influenced Speaker of the House Mike Johnson to take the path that he did and how he actually got it done? And so let's get beyond those headlines and let's think again.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Always pleased to have joining us on the program, Representative Blake Moore. And Representative, obviously a very hectic week last week, rolling into the weekend there in our nation's capital. You were in the room where a lot of those conversations happened. Just give us your perspective. We've been talking about Speaker of the House Mike Johnson, his willingness to put those into much smaller bills so you could have very specific votes. And it was really this idea of, hey, this is the right thing. And if it cost me my job, it cost me my job. That willingness to say it's time to act and do. Give us your perspective in terms of how that all played out.
Yeah, I would just add on the outset, I've never been more impressed with somebody when we can look at the conference and say, look, I know this is the direction that we need to go. We have to act on these things, and I don't care if it potentially causes me to lose my job. I think in politics, we all have to be that way to some degree. This shouldn't be, he wasn't seeking this out, and he was willing to do something difficult and took a lot of criticism for it. And I obviously believe it was the right direction. And these things have been, you know, plaguing us for months and months and months. There was a lot that went into all of these conversations, and things have unfolded in Israel, in the Middle East, you know, while these plans have been on the docket needing to get done. And I'm proud of the fact that he was willing to take that risk and move forward.
Yeah, I think it's actually the one question all of us as voters should look at, and that is, before you vote for anybody in any elected office, is what are they willing to do the right thing, even if it costs them their job? And if you can't find that, you're not going to find a lot of political courage or a spine when they actually need it the most. I think that's just a crucial piece of this. Whether people agree or disagree on the policy, that those are different debates. But I think the process matters. And I know that's one of the things that you've looked at since you've been back in Washington, D.C., is getting back to that regular order and process. Because then even if the result is not what you want, you can at least say, hey, we did the right process. And usually that's going to lead you to a better result.
Speaker Johnson made it a strong point to say, we need to let the House work its will. And everybody came in at a different perspective, whether you were talking Indo-Pacific, you're talking Ukraine or Israel, or the thing that's going to get left out is that fourth bill that we did that I think is one of the most strongest key pieces to all of this. And that was the part of the Repo Act. Mm. Russia had, there are the Western world from our European allies to us, we have hundreds of billions of dollars of Russian seized central bank assets that in times of conflict like this, you have an opportunity to seize that and repurpose that. And they've invaded Ukraine, and there's an opportunity to seize and repurpose and use that money to strengthen Ukraine, to also hopefully bring Russia to the negotiating table to end this conflict. Everybody wants to end this conflict. And we've now initiated strength that we've never had before with regards to what's called the Repo Act, to take that Russian money and provide it and transfer it to Ukraine so they can use that as strength to fend off this aggression.
Yeah, I think it's an important component to that. Give us a little sense from your conversations with your colleagues back there in terms of the messages that what was passed over the weekend send, not just to specific allies of Israel, Ukraine, and Taiwan, but what does it send to other allies around the world, and what message is it sending to our adversaries around the world?
China invades Taiwan, like many things have pointed towards, and Xi Jinping has emphasized. Hopefully it's something we can deter If he does that, we have a 9% drop in our GDP. I think that's what the estimate is. That's a far bigger cost than this, than what we just did in this piece that allows for Taiwan to have capital to purchase, you know, U.S. Artillery and defense weapons. And it's a cost to us. It absolutely is. You and I have talked on this show numerous times about our debt and deficit woes. If we go into global conflict, it is going to be far worse on our fiscal situation than if we're able to have a country like going to Ukraine now. These folks are willing to fight for themselves. These folks are willing to defend their own liberty. And if we're providing them some resources that largely is replenishing our own stocks, and most of that money is actually still spent in the U.S. and portions of it that aren't, like a $9 billion humanitarian piece that will help restore some of that. Well, Europe's doing most of the humanitarian work. That's another misconception. But we're forming that in a loan package that President Trump, of all people, that was his idea. And we took it and ran with it and actually put it into legislation. So there is all that nuance that kind of goes into all these discussions. But, you know, from October 7th and providing Israel what they need to replenish their Iron Dome and also help the Palestinian people that are caught in this horrible conflict that Hamas has created, you know, that's that part of that package. What I talked about with Indo-Pacific and making sure that Taiwan has their ability to purchase defense mechanisms. In Ukraine, they're fighting themselves. We do not want a NATO conflict over there that we have to put men and women, U.S. troops in that theater. And if we can do that and strengthen them and hopefully end this conflict, and I'm hopeful that this gets us in that direction.
Yeah. One of the components that I think was really the hotly contested piece for a number of months now has been dealing with our own border, our own immigration challenges and security down at the southern border. Give us a sense in terms of where that conversation has been, how it kind of ebbed and flowed over the course of the last week, and then what you see as the possibility as it relates to that moving forward.
So it actually ebbs and flows back to September. And I have to constantly remind folks that when we had an opportunity right before the government would be set to shut down, or you could do a month-long extension of that, we had a bill on the floor, heavily supported by folks like Jim Jordan and members of Dusty Johnson. They negotiated this piece within our conference that would do our border bill that ends catch and release, and it reinstates Remain in Mexico, and all those things that we know have had success in dealing with the cartels down at the border. We had 21 Republicans vote against it for 1 month of government funding. And so now, when we finalize the appropriations process, Speaker Johnson doesn't even have all of the Republicans supporting border policy when you exchange it with you know, like a government funding appropriations bill. And there isn't a sizable group of a minority, definitely, but they wouldn't do a bill that was strongly supportive of our border and also supporting some of our allies. And so Speaker Johnson doesn't have the leverage to get everything that we want at the border. There was opportunities over the last several months to look at a negotiated peace. The Senate had been working on something that had Ukraine support, Israel support, as well as, changes in our immigration policy. And it wasn't everything that we wanted in the House Republican side. I will admit, too, that it didn't do enough of the things like ending catch and release and fixing parole authority that we wanted. But Speaker Johnson doesn't have that leverage right now, right, with a two-seat majority and a Democrat in the White House with Chuck Schumer. He just doesn't have that leverage. And we tried and tried and tried to find a way to cobble this together. I have criticisms of our own side by not willing to articulate, okay, what wins can we have? Can we just do ending catch and release, still an enormous amount of support for Ukraine? If we had catch and release ended with Ukraine, you would have actually had even more Republicans last Saturday supporting a Ukraine package. You wouldn't have had everybody, but you would have had several more. Yeah. And that was our missed opportunity as Republicans. And that's why I appreciate coming on this show, because I can criticize, Democrat policy or President Biden, but I can also show a little bit of the inside on where we've come short. Yeah. And that was the part that, having Russian tanks enter Kyiv is a sight that no American should want to see. But also, I'm concerned that we're now reserved to just a change in administration instead of a legislative fix to what's going on at the border. I highly anticipate if President Trump were to win the election here in November, there would be several changes to the border policy that I would very much support. I just wish we as congressmen and women and body of Congress could actually address this. And there's real proposals out there, and we keep failing at finding a way to do it.
Yeah, and that's such an important key because things we know that what gets done by executive order gets undone by executive order and creates more uncertainty. And it is when Congress does it, then you got a real chance and a real shot to do the thing that's going to create lasting success or lasting impact.
Exactly.
Great perspective as always. That's why we appreciate you coming on the show to speak the truth and explore all the nuances underneath the headlines and the red hot rhetoric that's usually a distraction and prevents us from actually talking about the things we need to get to. Representative Blake Moore, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Important conversation. So we're going to stay with that conversation and look at a little bit of what is inside of that bill. Where does that money actually go? Matthew Petty from Reason, Reason.com, is going to join us coming up next to continue the conversation on what's happening on these major bills taking place in our nation's capital. We'll be right back.
Think again on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson. Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, we're staying with the conversation as it relates to the package that has aid for Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and some other things tucked in there. Just in the last 20 minutes, the Senate advanced the bill onto the floor, which starts the clock ticking 30 hours unless they work out some deal to collapse some of that time. So within the next 30 hours, we will have a vote in the Senate and likely final passage of that, which the president has indicated that he will sign once it gets to his desk. What we want to do now is we want to go underneath the headlines and pass just the numbers on the top line. And we want to look at where's all this money going to go and what does it actually do? Matthew Petty, of course, is the assistant editor at Reason. Reason.com covers U.S. national security policy and its interactions with American society and domestic politics as well. And Matthew, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on again.
So give us a sense here. Obviously, we look at the top line number, $95 billion, mostly characterized as a military spending package. Give us the breakdown in terms of what that is, and then I want you to unpack for us where's all that money really going?
Right. So the aid bill, I mean, it's not really an aid bill because most of the money is being spent in the U.S. It's being spent either on the U.S. military, U.S. military buildup in Europe and Asia and the Middle East, or it's being spent to replenish weapons that the U.S. has given to Ukraine and Israel and countries in Asia. And it is also spending on American weapons companies to buy weapons for these countries. So, you know, the way the bill was sold was, we need to aid Ukraine and Israel right now. But a lot of this stuff is just weapons manufacturing contracts that, yeah, is going to go to those countries over the next few months and years. But it's really on the American end. It is a military buildup. It is responding, of course, to these conflicts in Eastern Europe and the Middle East. But that's and I can go line by line if you'd like, or section by section on what the different numbers are.
Yeah. Let's break it down just a little bit because I think it's interesting, and you pointed this out in your piece that the vast majority, the bulk of the money is going to go to kind of the military industrial complex. And there's been an interesting debate around that. Some saying, well, that's good. That's keeping money in the U.S. Others saying, wait, that's just more industrial complex money just kind of churning around. Still others have said, well, this will help us, you know, kind of phase out some of those outdated systems and allow us to replace them with better. Kind of break that all down for us.
Sure. Well, I think, yeah, it's true that every country in the world needs to spend on its defense, right? Everyone needs an army. We don't live in a perfect world. But I do think that there's a bit of an American overstretch right now where we're throwing money. You know, the U.S. is involved some conflicts more directly than others in a lot of different places in the world. And we're throwing a lot of money at it with the idea that, you know, we could just keep printing money, throwing it into buying weapon systems and basically keep these going indefinitely. But we're seeing already in Ukraine that, you know, there's shortages that we just can't match. Like, you know, artillery shells, for example, are easy to build, and we can throw more money at the factories and keep scaling up production of that. But even then, Russia and Ukraine are firing more artillery than we can make the ammunition for. And then more advanced systems like missiles, like Patriot missiles for air defense or Tomahawk missiles for ground attack. I mean, these are complex systems. They require skilled labor, specialized parts. They take years to put together. And we're burning through those really fast. And I think there's a little bit of an illusion in, you know, Congress and Washington in general that we can just keep throwing money at this problem and it'll go away. But I don't think, I think that the problem is how many, you know, I don't have a crystal ball of how we can get out of all these wars. But, you know, the problem is that we're in too many of them. It's not really sustainable.
Yeah. Oh, and I think you point that out in your piece, that the risk of getting dragged further and further into these conflicts without a real strategy in terms of what does winning look like, what is the exit strategy, you know, all of those things gets pretty complicated pretty fast. And so I think it is a risk that we take in terms of the further we get in, and it's sort of like when you make a bad purchase and you compound it by making more bad purchases to justify the first purchase. And sometimes I think in these conflicts, we make an investment and then we feel like we have to double down on that investment to justify the first one. And I think that gets a little intractable at some point. There are some components of this that you pointed out in your piece actually do meet the standard of aid, around $9 billion. Give us a sense of what that's about.
Sure. Yeah, it's around $9 billion in worldwide kind of refugee and humanitarian aid. And I think it was probably put there. It was an interesting compromise because some of it is aid to Palestinians, which I think is a compromise with Democrats who are uneasy with the way Israel's conducting its war in Gaza and the human suffering that's causing. But that's $2 billion of the $9 billion. Some of the other aid, I think it was in the Ukraine bill, so it seems to be going towards Ukrainian refugees. And it's also stipulated that the aid money will not go to the UN Relief Works Agency, which is the main Palestinian refugee agency. Israel has accused it of supporting Hamas. The UN Relief Works Agency says, no, this is a spurious allegation that Israel's made. And I think they just came out with an independent audit that said that basically, you know, said that this is an independent international organization. But because these allegations are hanging over it, I think in the American political system, as a compromise, they kind of had to make sure that none of the aid goes to them.
Yeah. Fascinating stuff. Matthew Petty, assistant editor at Reason, covers U.S. national security policy. And thanks for unpacking all of that. We always have to get what's underneath the nice titles and the fancy headlines to see what's in it, what it actually means, what it will actually produce in terms of results is always the big question there. Matthew, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Great perspective there from Matthew Petty from Reason, reason.com. You can check out his piece there. And this is one of those things that we always have to look at, and it's why we have to follow process, because that's where you find out what is in the bill, where is it actually going, what's the likely impact, what's the net outcome going to be or likely to be, what are the alternative plans if things go south or sideways. And so those are all important conversations that we have to get to, but often in the rush to get something through, we don't even have that debate on the floor of the House or the Senate. And so I think it's important that we have process so that we do get all the facts, get the transparency, get it in front of the American people, and then we can make decisions, we can take votes, and then we can hold people accountable for the results as well. All right, we'll step aside for some bottom of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. More Inside Sources coming up next on KSL News Radio.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Of course, as the old saying goes, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And of course, that applies in big ways when it actually comes to our health. We want to dig in this segment of the program, talking about why is it that Americans continue to have poor health, to get sicker, chronic disease, all of those things that continue to be mounting in our society. and what kind of prevention we should be looking at as a result of that to get better results. Dan Crippen served as the executive director of the National Governors Association and as a former director of the Congressional Budget Office, knows his way around these things. A fantastic piece in The Hill, prevention programs save lives and money, yet the budget process may undervalue them. And that's what I want to get to with this. And Dan, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Great piece at The Hill. People can check that out at thehill.com. Give us kind of the baseline, because you're a Congressional Budget Office guy. You can start with the baseline numbers. Tell us what they are and what they mean.
Well, the issue we've long had with prevention is that the costs are upfront. It's relatively easy, I shouldn't say easy, but easier to estimate what those costs are. But then the subsequent savings and better health and using less health care occurs down the line. And down the line could be more than the 10 years, which we normally think of as the maximum we do for budgets. And it could be 20 years, 30 years. And so there's just a lot we don't know. It makes it very difficult for CBO and others to score those savings, which would offset the costs certainly.
Yeah, and I think when you look at that, often that is the issue with Congress, as they're looking at some of these things in terms of a piece of legislation. They're always going to start with that Congressional Budget Office score. What's that? What is it actually going to cost? What does that look like over that window? Talk about some of the things that have been going on in the House to maybe change that dynamic so we can maybe assess some of those things like preventative health savings accounts in a little better way.
Well, as you just noted, the House Budget Committee has reported, in fact, the House has passed two bills. One would say to the Congressional Budget Office, it's okay, and we wish you would, give us some long-term estimates on prevention. And the bill also says, of course, we understand, given the uncertainty of these estimates, that it may not be fully usable for budget scorekeeping purposes, but we need to begin to build a structure, research necessary, to allow us to designate more funding for prevention. Just as a slide, and it's probably your questions will include this, but you alluded to it at the beginning, in which we now spend 75% of all of our healthcare dollars on chronic disease treatment. And we have worked for 30 years to try and figure out how to treat it better, and we figured out some things, including, importantly, new pharmaceuticals that will help. But if we don't figure out how to, if not cure, at least ameliorate some of these through prevention, we're just going to end up, the proverbial Don Quixote fighting the windmills.
Yeah, no question. And it really is a matter of, are you going to build the fence at the top of the cliff or just park the ambulances down at the bottom and sort it out at that point? One of the things that you noted in your piece is just some of those barriers to get to that in terms of the obstacles. How do we actually assess this, look at the upfront costs? But kind of walk us through what those back-end costs are really costing us in the country.
Well, are the disease the costs in taking care of these chronic diseases and diabetes, hypertension, cardiac issues, all are very expensive once they have they're very expensive to treat and generally give people shorter lives and a less pleasant life in many ways. So it's we know that there are costs coming from lack of prevention, but we don't know how well some of the prevention will actually affect those costs. Mm. We think, for example, and we're quite convinced, and there's some evidence, that being overweight can lead to increases in diabetes, especially type 2. And so that can lead to expensive and terrible consequences. If untreated, it could lead to amputations and blindness and other. And so we believe that if you reduce obesity, you reduce the incidence of diabetes. That evidence isn't quite as strong. We certainly don't know whether some of the new weight loss drugs, which seem to work to reduce weight, whether that will reduce diabetes either. Mm-hmm. And you may have to be on those drugs for the rest of your life. And so on. So there's a lot of unknown as to the effects of some prevention, although we're quite sure it has to be better.
Yeah.
And we know, you know, that it will help. Just don't know by how much or how soon.
Yeah. Well, I think this is an important effort. And again, it's bipartisan. It's one of those that everybody should rally around in terms of let's figure it out. Let's get to some better scorekeeping on the prevention side. Let's make sure we have transparency in the process. And ultimately, that will lead us to better results in terms of those health outcomes. And Dan Crippen, grateful to have you joining us today. Again, great piece in The Hill. You can check it out at thehill.com. Dan, thanks again for jumping on.
Anytime. Thank you.
All right. Again, that's Dan Crippen, served as the executive director of the National Governors Association and former director of the Congressional Budget Office. And that Congressional Budget Office is an important thing because that is kind of where the scorekeeping happens. And so a lot of times when you hear about bills that are working their way through Congress, they'll often wait and say, we're waiting for a CBO score, the Congressional Budget Office score, to say this is how much it will actually cost. Members of Congress from both sides of the aisle are pretty good at fudging the numbers. And so the CBO is sort of the umpire and says, well, it's probably going to cost a little more than that. Or you probably won't get as much tax revenue by increasing that particular tax. And so it's kind of the truth in advertising. The Congressional Budget Office takes away the nice titles, the fancy acronyms that members like to use with their bills, and gets them to that honesty and transparency component to see what is actually there. I think the work that Dan has been looking at and exploring in terms of preventative care and how do we actually get that into the process, because the current process doesn't really have a good way to evaluate those costs of preventative medicine, preventative health, preventative health savings accounts, those kinds of things. And so there has to be a way to get at those numbers so we can say, wow, if we invest in X, it's going to save us down the line because we're going to have people who aren't dealing with these issues or won't be required to be on these medications, you know, for years and years of their life, or they won't end up in an emergency room or long stay in terms of hospital stays and so on. And so all of those are important conversations. And it's another one of those areas that, again, it's under the surface. It's under the headline. It's under all the political stuff because nobody's talking a lot about what Dan shared with us today because it's the hard work and heavy lifting of legislating and learning what can be done, what does it cost to do it, and what will the results be if we actually enact it. And that's the serious part of legislating. And you have to have serious people in Congress who are willing to sharpen the pencils instead of the knives and crunch the numbers and do the math and do the research and have those conversations and have those kind of hearings, not the performative stuff we see in a lot of hearings in Congress these days, but the real hearings to get down to the real issues. And I think this is one crucial area that we are not having nearly enough important conversations about when it comes to preventative health programs and how we can do that better in this country. All right, we'll step aside for some top of the hour news. Don't go anywhere. We are going to kick off hour number two with Frank Bruni. He has a new book coming up called The Age of Grievance and Why Pessimism is Driving Our Politics. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
KSL FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios, this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Well, if you look at the headlines on most days, leading media, political voices, if you listen to what their headlines are, you'll probably be convinced that all is lost, that we're going somewhere in a handbasket, somewhere south, that everything is lost, that we're a nation in decline, that there's nothing but bad things ahead. But if you dig underneath that, you have to get to a different kind of conversation where we can look at, is it all just about grievance being the most important thing? Do we constantly have to be in a state of being offended or even preemptively offended? So how do we get past the grievance and get to a better place? Let's begin.
Think you know the news of the day? Think again with Boyd Matheson on KSL News Radio.
Well, it's time to rethink what we think we know about the grievance age that we live in. Of course, on this show, every day we try to separate the rage from the reason while we elevate the conversation. And someone who is doing exactly that is Frank Bruni, professor of public policy and journalism at Duke University. He's a contributing writer for the New York Times. And he is the author of a book that comes out very soon called The Age of Grievance. I've been looking forward to this all day today. And Frank, welcome to the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
So give us your genesis to all of this in terms of how did we get to the age of grievance? It doesn't seem to be natural in our DNA, but here we are.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are a lot of answers to that. I mean, part of it is America's turn toward pessimism over recent decades. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is social media and some of the kinds of conversations it encourages. A lot of it is our political leaders right now. Yeah. They're sort of modeling, you know, a pettiness and a vindictiveness that invariably trickles down to the rest of us. But when you put it all together, we're in a state of dysfunction and discord that I think is really threatening the very survival of our democracy. But I think we can do things differently. I think it's time to take a good, long, hard look at ourselves, ask if this is who we want to be, make some changes, and find a way to more productive conversations and a much kind of cooler temperature to our public discourse.
Yeah. One of the things that you pointed out in an excerpt from your book that was recently published is this whole idea that we've gone from being this optimistic, look at all the possibilities, blue sky, shoot the moon, American dream, exceptionalism, all of those things, to this pessimism. Walk us through that and kind of how we landed there, or where did we take a wrong turn that led us to such a pessimistic space?
Well, somewhere along the way, I think our kind of expectations grew outsize, and any shortfall we took in a kind of much, much more personal and bitter way than we needed to. But all I know is in my adult lifetime, and my guess is you've had the same experience, I've been absolutely gobsmacked by how we turn from optimism to pessimism, by the fact that it used to be a given that when you asked, when you surveyed Americans and said, do you expect your kids to do better than you did? A significant majority would say yes. That was kind of part and parcel of the American dream. Now, when you ask that question, you get much different answers. And I think what happens is when people no longer believe the pie is expanding, they become much more competitive and petty about their own slices of the pie. And I think you're seeing that in the conversations we're having. You're seeing that in politics, which emphasizes, here's why you shouldn't vote for that person. That person will help the people you disagree with at your expense. And it pits us against one another in a way that I think may be unsustainable.
I think that's so important. We end up in this zero-sum game of if you're doing better, that means I'm doing less better. Therefore, you're bad and evil. And it's kind of that the lowest common denominator of if you're going to climb higher, I'm going to pull you back down to my level. Not necessarily right. Try to work for both of us to move upward. One of the other things that you point out that I think is so important, you referenced it in how we look to the future and how we think our children's lives are going to be. We live in this country that has, I think, lifted more people out of poverty and created more opportunity than probably just about any society in history when you look at it globally. And now we suddenly seem to be looking in a completely different direction. What's the cure? What's the antidote to that?
You know, I think we have to rediscover a sort of reasonable patriotism. Somewhere along the way in recent years, to call yourself a patriot, to be proud of America, to be proud to be an American, somehow that became like a sign that you were unsophisticated or that you didn't care about all the progress the country still needed to make. Now, listen, we have not lived up to our ideals, and the more perfect union that we're constantly citing, we need to work harder toward that because a lot of Americans don't have an equal chance, and we haven't been as fair-minded and as inclusive as we should be. But that doesn't change the fact that this country has done enormous good for its own citizens, for the world, and I don't think feeling bad about being American, I don't think you know, younger people often say they think the founding fathers were a source of more evil than good. I don't think that's true to the American story. And I, most of all, I don't think it pushes us forward to a better place in the way that a kind of more clear-eyed appraisal of all the good we've done as well as the bad would lead us.
Yeah, we're definitely a believer in warts and all history, but not just warts. because it's always easy to poke holes in history, but we have to remember when you go back in history, it's like going to a foreign country. They do things different, and it's easy for us to judge them, as you said, as part of the problem and part of the evil that goes on. I think we've also had our politics that have gotten us and conditioned us to respond inappropriately to the negative base emotions of fear, anger, frustration, contempt, because that's a good way to raise money or try to win a political campaign. And so I always like to get to this therefore what component to all of this. As you've gone through your book and as you've dug into these kinds of things, what's the therefore what? What should each of us individually do different or think different today when it comes to the age of grievance?
I think we need to rediscover a little virtue called humility. And in fact, you referenced an excerpt of my book that recently ran in The Atlantic about American pessimism. The New York Times ran an excerpt from the last chapter of the book in which I say that humility is the antidote to grievance. And what I mean by that is we all need to pause and remember that it's okay if someone disagrees with us and if we disagree with them, that there's still a productive conversation to have because our opinion doesn't need to win the day. We don't need to be entirely right because guess what? No one of us is entirely right. We prosper and we're most content when we value the collective good as well as our individual whims. All of those are exercises in humility, and I think if we all humble ourselves a little bit, we can advance common goals in a way that we're working against right now.
No question about it. We spoke last week during the eclipse that Neil deGrasse Tyson said that the cosmic perspective is humility. And from that humility comes curiosity where we can ask, I wonder why she thinks that way. I wonder why he thinks that's a good solution to that. And gets us to a very different place than just this place of grievance and pessimism. Great book. Everyone should check that out coming. So grateful to have Frank Bruni join us on the program today. Nick, good luck with the book. We want to have you come back and continue the conversation. The book is The Age of Grievance. So watch for that. An important conversation coming up soon. Thanks again, Frank.
Thank you.
All right, the politics of pessimism, why so many American leaders are advancing a new kind of nihilism. I think Frank's hit it right on the head there, and it's an important conversation, but it all begins, as he said, with humility. We'll be right back.
Think again
on Inside Sources with Boyd Matheson.
Inside Sources.
Inside Sources.
America's voice of reason. Boyd Matheson.
On Utah's home for elevated conversation.
Inside Sources on KSL News Radio.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. Of course, all of us want to live a fulfilled, authentic life. And of course, that takes time and practice and patience, all of those things. And we need to learn ever more about ourselves and how we respond to everything that's coming at us, especially those feelings. And an interesting area that we want to dig into in this segment is the counterfeit emotions that often get in the way of personal development, often keep us a safe distance from having the crucial conversations we need in our life and getting us to those places where we can be authentic and real and get the results that we hope for. Curtis Morley is a Wall Street Journal bestselling author. His focus is on bringing to light the principles behind a book that he has coming out soon called Counterfeit Emotions. And we want to get into that, what this unmasking, these deceptive emotions that create destructive cycles and really disconnect us in our lives. And Curtis, welcome to the show.
Hi, Boyd. Thanks so much for having me.
So let's start with kind of the baseline on all of this. You often talk about connection and how important that is. And what are some of these deceptive emotions or these counterfeit emotions that are getting in the way and producing some destructive cycles?
Yeah, so counterfeit emotions are any emotion that looks, acts, and feels like an authentic emotion but creates destructive cycles of disconnection in our lives. And a good example of that that is easy to understand is guilt and shame. Guilt is actually a beautiful, healthy, important emotion. Shame is it's an insidious counterfeit.
And so as you look at that, kind of walk us through what happens when we're kind of in that space where we're not sure if what we're feeling is the shame or the guilt, or how do those get blended to create that confusion rather than clarity?
Yeah, up until about 10 years ago, most scientific studies, most of the way we talked about guilt and shame was this as if it were the same concept. But Brené Brown, as well as University of Sweden, have done studies recently that showed that shame has a direct correlation into addiction, into drug use, into bullying, into suicidal ideation. Shame is one of the lowest frequency emotions we can feel. And guilt, on the other hand, guilt is actually a higher frequency emotion that helps us to make changes, helps us to connect with others, and even is now shown that shame is the way into addiction and all these other things. Guilt is actually the way out.
Mm. Oh, that is fascinating. And I know you go through a number of different emotional cycles and kind of looking at those counterpart. One that I wanted to dig into today that I know will be part of your book is this whole idea of being kind versus being nice. Another one of those where we often get a little bit confused.
Yeah, this is one that sometimes breaks people's brain because we're taught ever since being a little kid, even Thumper's best friend told us or Bambi's best friend Thumper told us, if you can't say nothing nice, don't say nothing at all. And the truth is that nice is actually the counterfeit of kind. Mm. It is so sneaky because we think we're supposed to be nice. And truly, nice is not very nice. Nice is a defense mechanism.
Mm. And so kind of play that out for us. Unpack that a little bit in terms of how we see that in our personal lives as well as in our businesses.
Yeah. So nice is... super easy example is the spinach in the teeth or the zippers down or things like that. Nice says, I don't want to embarrass you, so I'm not going to tell you there's spinach in your teeth. But that's not actually very nice, and it's not kind, because then all of a sudden now you've got spinach in your teeth for the rest of the day, and now you get embarrassed over and over again. And with kind always leans in. Kind is willing to have hard conversations in love, not in a mean way, but in love. Kind is always willing to have those conversations. And the thing about nice is nice will never rock the boat. Mm. And because nice won't rock the boat, it also means it won't row the boat. Because if you're going to progress the relationship, if you're going to row the boat and head towards a destination, that means it's going to rock from time to time. And so kind is willing to row the boat. And when needed, it's also willing to rock the boat.
Yeah, that's such an important thing. I think we often avoid those conversations because we want to be nice, or we don't want to offend, or we don't want to make someone uncomfortable. And so we don't get to the real conversation we need to get to. You go through a series of kind of opposites and back and forth, hope and expectation, kind and nice, as we've talked about, power versus control. What are some of the others that we should be mindful of, and what is the one that's kind of the answer to all of them?
Well, there is one emotion. There is one emotion that has no counterfeit, and that's peace. Peace is the only emotion without a counterfeit, the only authentic emotion without a counterfeit. And every other emotion that is authentic has a counterfeit. Some of them, the most important, that are also the most misunderstood. One of them is pain versus misery. Pain is an authentic emotion, and people don't actually want to hear that. We don't want to hear that pain is the authentic emotion that helps us to grow, whereas misery, you know, there's a saying that no pain, no gain, right? Because pain actually takes us somewhere.
Right.
The saying with misery is misery loves company. Misery only spins back on itself. And misery is based in two other emotions, blame and shame. Mm. And because of that, it spins on itself. So it only comes back to itself, because without more misery, without that company, it actually dies. Mm. And so misery craves more misery.
Yeah, it's like that bitterness. And I think going back to this element of peace, you know, you only have to forgive once, but to be bitter or to have that grudge, you have to recreate all those negative base emotions every day. You have to keep, as you said, it turns back on itself and it feeds on itself. And if it doesn't feed on itself, then ultimately it dies, which is why we get into some of those vicious cycles of all of that. So what's one thing that we all can do today to be a little more aware in terms of some of those counterfeit emotions that might be keeping us from getting to better solutions?
Yeah, one of the best things is the recognition of, am I in an authentic emotion or a counterfeit? And there's four criteria to know if an emotion is authentic or counterfeit. The first is connection. The second is direction. Where does this emotion take me? The third is motivation. Is it motivated in love and surrender, or is it motivated in fear and control? And the fourth is valuation. Where does this emotion value me at, and where does it value you at? Mm. If it values us each as having divine worth and being eternal beings, then that's an authentic. If it says, I'm worthless, and not only worthless, but I'm worth less, meaning it gets into comparison, saying I'm not as handsome or tall or strong or whatever it is, then we know that that's a counterfeit. And just the recognition of going through those four steps, connection, direction, motivation, and valuation, is the first step in understanding, am I feeling an authentic or am I feeling a counterfeit emotion?
That's so important. I think there's so many applications to that, whether it's what we're hearing coming in from political parties and politicians who are trying to leverage those counterfeit emotions to get you to donate to their campaign or vote for their cause or be angry and upset and have a grievance mentality, or whether it's just simply what we see on social media and how that we're intaking that and what that's doing to our state of mind and to the state of our relationships. We have to be able to step back and always ask those questions. Those four areas, I think, are so crucial to figure out, what am I feeling? Why am I feeling that? Is this counterfeit? Is someone manipulating those, or am I just reacting to those? This is a really important conversation to get to. Curtis Morley, again, entrepreneur, educator, thought leader, innovator, and really excited to see this book come forward in terms of counterfeit emotions. It's something we all need to learn because it's becoming more important, especially with AI and the continuance of social media and a lot of political conversations, to get back to mm-hmm. that authenticity and the peace that you described. Curtis, thanks so much for joining us today. Great insight.
Thanks, Boyd.
All right, we'll step aside for one last commercial break. We'll come back with some final thoughts on Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hear elevated conversation on crucial issues. Boyd Matheson on Inside Sources.
Welcome back to Inside Sources here on KSL News Radio. It's great to be with you today. As always, I am Boyd Matheson. As we round out the program today, one of my favorite parts of the day is the morning, the early morning, when I just get to scour the news a little bit, look for some things that maybe are off the beaten path or beyond the headlines, and I always find something that gets me thinking. And that's the best part of the day, is to have something stir you enough to say, I want to think about that a little bit more, or I want to dig a little deeper onto that. And today was an interesting one. It actually was in the National Catholic Register, a really interesting piece by John Clark. And he opens his piece with what really grabbed my attention and got me not just thinking, but remembering some important people and some important principles. John Clark began his piece describing a recent interview, which actually was written in the New York Times, that included the Charles Schwab CEO, Walt Bettinger. And Mr. Bettinger actually tells the story in this piece about the most impactful test he ever took. He said it was his final exam that he had studied diligently for and felt that he was absolutely prepared to go in and do well. And the business course test contained a question that he was not expecting. I always love those kind of questions. Those are often the most important questions. And in fact, he said that on this particular final test, there was only one question, a single question. And then Walt Bettinger described it. He said the teacher handed out the final exam. It was a single sheet of paper. He said that really surprised him because he figured that it would be a very long test. It was the final for this business class. And he said once everyone had received the paper from the teacher, the professor said, go ahead and turn it over. Everyone turned over their exam paper, only to find that both sides of the sheet of paper were blank. Both sides were blank. So then the professor said, I've taught you everything I can teach you about business in the last 10 weeks. But the most important message, the most important question, and the question of the exam is this. What is the name of the lady who cleans this building? Mr. Bettinger, of course, had no clue. He said her name was actually Dottie. He said, I didn't know Dottie. I'd seen her, but I had never taken the time to ask her name. He went on to say that in failing that test, yes, he failed the test, he learned an important lesson. And he said, I've tried to know every Dottie I've worked with ever since. I think it's a pretty important lesson in a business class. Is so often it's the Dotties of the world that make all the difference in the world. And if you're going to be a real leader, if you're going to be an authentic leader, if you're going to be a high impact and influential leader, you better know who Dottie is and what Dottie does in your business or in your community. Those are the people that stir me the most. In fact, as I think back on my time in our nation's capital, I discovered where American exceptionalism is actually housed in the United States Capitol. It's not in the offices of the elected officials. It's not the senators and the representatives in the House. It's in some pretty amazing people who, like Dottie, made all the difference in the building. One of those for me was Coach David West, and he was always found around the gallery of the Senate. His enthusiasm for the chamber, he loved the country. And he just had a desire to make a difference. He was just infectious. Big smile, big bear hug every time you saw him. And you go underneath the surface of Coach David West, working there on the Senate side of the Capitol. There are countless, I am sure there are just countless young Senate staffers who found incredibly wise counsel, encouragement, and confidence because of their interaction with Coach West. And even though I was a little older chief of staff when I was in Washington, D.C., his commitment to people and to the institution and to the country changed me. And I have found out over the years since that Coach West, the number has to be in the thousands of struggling staffers that Coach West just took under his wing and just helped. Some of them went through really hard things. Divorce, separation, loss of a parent or a spouse. Some got wrapped up in addiction. And Coach West would bring them in to his place. He would walk with them. He would go visit them. And I heard stories of him going to see people who were in therapy, who were in treatment programs for addiction. And he just stayed connected. And he made a difference. And as I look at it, I think Coach West made a far bigger difference in his role than a lot of folks did in their official role, the people who have names on doors and have offices with big staffs. But Coach West was one of those who just simply made a difference. I saw others who worked in the Senate dining room. Same thing. The moment you walked in, you were the most important person in the Capitol that day. And they paid attention to every detail. They really epitomized that American exceptionalism. And as always, it's never defined by wealth or social status or fame. It's just found in the lives of those who choose to enrich other people. I think America is one of the most exceptional places on the planet, not because of who we are or where we live or our military might or economic power. It's extraordinary. It's exceptional because of what we do. Individually and collectively. And I think it's important for all of us to remember, to look for, and to commit to live that way. And you better know Dottie's name if you're going to be an effective leader. All right, that wraps that up for us on Inside Sources today here on KSL News Radio. I am Boyd Matheson. Thanks for joining us. And as always, as you go out into the world today, make sure you see something that inspires, say something that uplifts, and do something today that makes a difference.
KSL-FM Midvale.
KSL Salt Lake City.
From the KSL Common Spirit Health Studios,
this is KSL News Radio.
Utah's news, traffic, and weather station.